Support for KNKX comes from WSECU, a not-for-profit community credit union now open in downtown Bellevue, serving members at their newest branch at the corner of Northeast 2nd and 108th Avenue Northeast. More information at WSECU.org.
A patient that is lethargic and having a hard time walking, they might just come in and want to lay down. We'll take their temperature, and their temperature will be below normal by a degree or two. And then while they're laying there, they might just start urinating on themselves.
Oof, this sounds pretty bad. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, you're listening to Sound Effect, and this is Shepard Thorpe. And yeah, with a name like Shepard, he is a veterinarian. He works at Blue Pearl Veterinary Hospital in South Tacoma. And now let's get back to our medical mystery and our patient, a dog.
Sometimes their pupils are a little bit dilated and they'll be shy around the head. So if you move your hand too quickly towards their face to examine their eyes or their mouth, their eyes will blink and they'll pull their head back. When they're more severely affected, they could have tremors and twitches, which look very abnormal. Most of the owners are concerned that there's something internally wrong with their dog. I've heard some owners say, has my pet had a stroke? Is this some type of seizure? I think that my pet may have gotten into something, but I have no idea.
Okay, don't worry. This dog is going to be okay, I promise.
We can pretty quickly realize that these are symptoms that are consistent with a marijuana exposure.
That's right. These dogs are stoned. These are pot dogs. Now, 20 years ago, Shep would see a case like this every once in a while, but today with marijuana being legal and coming in all kinds of edible forms, Shep says he sees intoxicated dogs like 3 or 4 times a week. So many of these cases come through that treating them has become a pretty important source of revenue for the clinic. Detoxing your dog can cost between $500 and $1,000, which is a good reminder to keep your stash out of reach.
You wouldn't want to bring a plate of cookies and put it on the coffee table and not expect the Labrador Retriever to get to the cookies.
Our pets. We love them, we hate to see them suffer. Even though it might be kind of amusing to finally have the answer to that question, what would my dog be like if it were stoned, ma'am? Well, Shep has never lost one of these patients, and he says the less severe cases recover just fine by riding things out in a dark, quiet space. Today on Sound Effect, our theme is pet projects. Cats, dogs, birds, monkeys, and some humans. For this story, let me set the scene. In a little parking lot at the Washington Park Arboretum in Seattle, a rather regal-looking cockatoo is perched atop a white minivan, and he's chattering affably with the family that's about to pile back into it.
We've been having a conversation with him. He's been sitting on our car and jumping up and down in excitement, and all the kids are enjoying just watching him. So
you could tell right away that he's no ordinary bird, can't you?
Yeah, I don't know what kind of bird he is, but he's really interested in socializing with us.
He is, as it turns out, a very outgoing bird. And I mean that literally. This pet bird flies free, and he has plenty of friends who know him by name, Peaches McFly.
I'm Taryn. I am the human behind Mr. Peach McFly, the wandering cockatoo of Madison Valley. Peach, are you silly? Good boy, can you bark? He does laugh, and it's really cute. I used to be really shy 12 years ago, and Peach sort of brought me out of that box a little more than I expected, because you have to have the ability to talk to people because people are so fascinated by him, and he's so engaging that you can't help it. We used to just leave the window open in our old house that was just up the street here, and he would kind of come and go as he pleased. Most of the time on a nice summer day, he would be gone all day. So he first made friends with our neighbor right across the alley, and they would go hang out, and he would, you know, watch TV at his house and hang out, go to his parties. Once he makes friends with somebody and, like, we're all comfortable with each other, then, yeah, I would let people take him into their house.
I've always called him my neighborhood bird. I'm Marguerite Yeo, and he'll land either on my gate or on my front porch, and he'll call out, and then I'll know he's there. And Peaches will cuddle sometimes, you know, and when I feel like it's getting dark and it's time to say bye, I say, okay, night-night, Peaches, and he'll say, no, night-night, no, night-night. Yeah, so he's a character. The neighbor that was two or three doors down loved Peaches. I think it's Brian.
I'm Brian, and I live up the street in the Arboretum, which is where I met Peaches. One of the cool feelings would be like to go out in the middle of the street, and you'd see him up on a rooftop 2.5 stories high, and you put your arms out like and across, and then he just like flies down off this rooftop, and people walking by are like, wow, what's going on?
I knew he was a free-range bird in a sense that he was trained to fly around freely outside and knows how to go back home and will answer to his owner's call. That was what I knew about Peaches.
I found him on consignment at a pet store 12 years ago in Gig Harbor, and he was too smart for his own good immediately. That became apparent. It was like a going stir crazy in a little apartment. And I taught him lots of tricks, and we did all sorts of different puzzles and toys, and nothing kept this bird busy enough or focused for long enough. I mean, they're meant to fly. And it wasn't until I started working at a zoo and working with free flight trainers and working with Chris Bureau, who's a professional free flight trainer. I took his classes and found out that people do indeed do this, that people take their birds outside and let them fly without harnesses, without leashes, without restriction. It's sad, I think, but it's very much ingrained as the dogma of owning a parrot that you clip its wings, you put it in a cage, and it lives in your living room. It never goes outside. It doesn't experience other people. It doesn't experience other things. And God forbid it goes outside and flies. Once your bird is trained to a certain level and you can trust them, it doesn't matter where they are. He knows his way around. He's never been lost. He's only been missing because of human intervention the times that he has disappeared. His run-in that was in the news was, I think, blown out of proportion a little bit. He was missing for a grand total of 3 hours from Cal Anderson Park, and he ended up in a parking lot near QFC down the street. And some lady had found him. Someone else had said, I think this might be Peach McFly. And instead of contacting me at that point, they flagged down some police officers and then spent an hour and a half coaxing him into the car. So when I finally was contacted, it was over Instagram by the police officer who was like, hey, I think I have your bird. So I went and picked him up, and everything was fine. We took pictures with the police officers, and it was super cute. But it ended up on the police blotter because he had been in the car, so he was booked, so they had to report all of it. The worst incident we had was a couple years ago now. He was flying out in our neighborhood and went missing over a weekend. So what ended up happening, we don't know the whole story, but he got taken to Seattle Animal Shelter. They unfortunately don't see a lot of birds, didn't know a whole lot about it, didn't look at his band, and called a lady who had reported missing the same species of bird. So she comes and takes a look, and Peaches steps right up because he's super friendly, and she goes, yep, this is Rosie, I'm taking her home. So she took Rosie to the pet store and got her wings clipped, and Peaches was miserable. And within a day, she realized this bird now couldn't stand her because he had his wings clipped and was just pouting. So she found our information on all of these message boards that where we've been posting looking for him, and called me up and said, I might have your bird. So Kevin and I raced down to Renton, where she was, and picked up Peach, and he was beyond excited to see us. I think it had only been maybe 3 days at that point, but it was a frantic 3 days. there are haters for sure. That there were a lot of pretty upsetting posts that showed up. People that were saying, "This is your fault. You should have never let this bird outside. Birds belong in cages. Birds belong indoors. Birds belong with their wings clipped." And I stood by it the entire time while he was missing, that even if something awful had happened, that I would rather this bird get to live his life as a bird. There's danger in everyday life for everyone. People still let teenagers drive and they're terrifying. So it's the same for a bird. If you set them up as best as you can, you've done your due diligence, and it's not my place to change his life for my purposes.
Taryn Smethers calls herself Peaches McFly's publicist. We also heard from neighbors Marguerite and Brian. We have pictures of Peaches and a link to his Instagram page at our website, knkxsoundeffect.org. And just in case this story has made you want your own bird, Smethers has this word of warning.
Take a 3-year-old, give it a pair of pliers and the ability to fly, let it loose in your house, and then tell me you want a cockatoo.
This is Sound Effect from 88.5. I'm Gabriel Spitzer. Our theme today is pet projects, and this next story is about a person whose pet project is to make some animals a little bit less pet-like and perhaps a little bit more wild. And I'm joined in studio by the guy who found this story, our colleague Will James. Hey, Will.
Hey, Gabriel.
How did this cross your transom?
The first time I went for a run at Point Defiance Park in Tacoma, I was immediately struck by the sight of raccoons kind of lounging about the trail, often directly adjacent to signs that say "Do not feed the animals," as if daring us to break the rules. And that is a sight that's just hard to get out of your head.
Say more. What was it that it triggered in you that made you want to investigate?
Like any reasonable person, I view raccoons with some suspicion. They creep around at night. They rummage. They have little human hands. But these raccoons struck me as kind of whimsical at first, until I learned a little bit more about them, and they became sort of sympathetic characters.
Oh, it's sympathetic, really? I'm not inclined to sympathize with raccoons, I have to warn you.
Yeah, it turns out the fact that these raccoons are so tame and friendly is a bad thing. It's, you know, they're in some trouble. And that's why I decided to follow around a park ranger around Point Defiance Park for an afternoon, whose mission in life is, as you said, to kind of undomesticate these raccoons.
I assume you have some kind of training in what to do in the event of a, like a raccoon assault.
Well, I play roller derby, so I think I could handle one.
All right.
My name is Mary Krauser, and I am the park ranger at Point Defiance Park. We are headed into 5 Mile Drive, which is the main roadway that circles through the park, and it drives through our old growth forest. And just so you know, the speed limit is 20.
How hard do you think it will be to find a raccoon?
Usually, if they're out, they're pretty easy to find. They like to sit in full view on the side of the road, even in groups. But they might be deterred by the rain, just like lots of other animals. So there's one, two, on the left.
Nope, there you go.
Oh, wow. Yeah, can we pull?
Yeah, here, I'll pull over here.
Yeah, let's pull over.
Oh, wow, they're big. I don't know what I was expecting.
So describe what makes these raccoons at Point Defiance Park so unusual.
Well, definitely that they run up to cars is an unusual behavior. And then they also have some strange gestures and postures that they do. So you can see them actually sitting sort of on their rear end on the side of the road, and they'll have either their paws out, like hands asking for food, or sometimes they'll put their paws up and they'll stand on their back legs and reach toward a car window. They will even sit on the left-hand side of the road because every car has a driver. So they've learned all these things just by getting food rewards. Just like you can train a dog, using treats to do certain behaviors. These animals over time have learned to do certain things to get snacks. So I've seen people toss out, you know, an entire bag of Wonder Bread, you know, still in the package. I've seen lots of different kinds of cereals and chips, of course, French fries and things like that. Lots of bread products. People seem to think that raccoons need carbs, and they really don't. Raccoons are animals who should be eating, you know, high protein stuff like roots and insects and invertebrates and stuff, not crackers. Hi there.
Hello.
How's it going?
Good.
So just want to remind you that we don't allow animal feeding here in the park.
Okay.
They're cute to look at, but
I just want them.
We can't share any food with them. Yeah, no thank you. Please don't get that close to me, little raccoon.
He stuck his little paws out.
Yes, he did.
So why is it a bad thing that these raccoons are exceptionally friendly and delightful?
For the raccoons here in Point Defiance specifically, some of the top concerns are that raccoons carry diseases that are transmittable to humans and pets like dogs. And if we are feeding raccoons, they're more likely to approach humans and pets. It might also, you know, boost their population because they're getting all this extra food. Females might be able to have more young that survive. So we're going to get a higher population, and that also increases contact between the raccoons and humans and pets.
If the raccoons' population is artificially inflated by humans feeding them, they can be more susceptible to disease? Is that how it works?
That can be how it works, yes. If we have sort of a higher number of animals living here than would normally, you know, be supported by this ecosystem, that can cause a disease that pops up in the population to transmit more easily and cause kind of like a collapse. And that's happened here. Our most recent disease outbreak was canine distemper, and it hit the raccoon population in 2012. And we had a large die-off of animals. And that's something that you see often in species that are being fed by humans. Hang out in, there's one for you. They like to hang out in this kind of drain. Raccoons make so many noises. They will hiss and cluck and chirp and gurgle. What you doing? How are you?
You could tell how smart they are. You can kind of see the little gears turning as they watch us. Oh, there's five of them here. There's three in
and
that.
I think there's another one.
Are you like regular visitors to here?
Yeah, we are.
Can I ask you, do you ever see the raccoons around here? I mean, is that like a common occurrence?
Oh yeah, that's a lot of why we come.
So you actually come,
wildlife.
You come to see the raccoons?
To see the raccoons, we do.
What do you like
and
about
the deer.
Them?
And the deer.
And the scenery.
What do you like about the raccoons, I guess?
I mean, every time we come, there's something, there's a group of sometimes 15, sometimes little bitty ones. Just standing in the culvert there and just looking so cute.
A lot of people who I talk to think that they're doing something nice for the raccoon. And maybe they have memories of, you know, their grandma bringing them to Point Defiance when they were little and they would feed the raccoons. So now they're bringing their kids to, you know, feed the raccoons and show them how cute they are. So I think for a lot of people, it's very sentimental. And so I try to, you know, come at it also from that emotional standpoint of this is actually not helping these animals. And if you care about them, which I really believe these people do care about these animals, the best thing that you can do is to help them act more wild, not less wild.
Do you know that the feeding of the raccoons here at this park have been going on for that long, like that someone's grandma brought them here?
Yes, people have been feeding raccoons at Point Defiance Park for decades. In general, we have a history of using animals and even nature for entertainment. Humans have a tendency to anthropomorphize animals and just say, oh, they're cute and I should, you know, give them my snack so they'll come closer to me. I think it's a a very common behavior that's not just here in Point Defiance.
Is this the eighth raccoon we've seen? Or like the ninth?
At least. Hey, sleepy little buddy? What you doing? That was a yawn, I think. Go take a nap. Come out at night like a normal person. We are making direct eye contact right now. They are cute, but they're terrible.
That story from 88.5's Will James, who's with me in the studio now. Will, were you scared?
I was a little scared, but I think overall it made me a little bit sad. The fact that, you know, we love animals, we want to be close to wildlife, but the fact that we care about these animals requires us to keep our distance from them in a way.
It's like love in so many areas of life, isn't it?
It is. It certainly is.
Did you talk much about rabies? Because I don't know about you, but I am like petrified of rabies, which basically is kind of certain death.
In fact, before we went on this excursion, I did confess to Ranger Mary that I did not have a rabies vaccination up to date. And she was kind enough to inform me that humans don't typically get or need those. Which was a relief.
But that also means that you're still, you get them after you get rabies.
Yeah, it turns out it's a treatable condition.
Just one other thing. She alludes to this at the very end, but you were there in the middle of the day, right?
Yes.
Aren't raccoons supposed to be nocturnal?
They are, unless over the course of years and generations, you train them not to be.
Is it possible that at some point all these behaviors will change so radically over so many generations that we could evolve a species of domesticated raccoons?
I don't see why not. You know, I made a bunch of comparisons to Jurassic Park as we were driving in this car through this forest looking for these creatures that we were afraid would be driven into their hiding places by the rain. And, you know, as they say in Jurassic Park, just because we can do it, I don't know if we should.
Clever girl. Thanks, Will.
Thanks, Gabriel.
It's Sound Effect from 88.5, and our theme today is Pet Projects. I'm Gabriel Spitzer. The way we think about animals has evolved a lot over the years. Take the zoo. In the early days of Seattle's Woodland Park Zoo, all of the monkeys were incarcerated in cages in the monkey house. And then in 1940, looking to move the monkeys into a setting that vaguely resembles nature, the monkeys were relocated to a little human-made island surrounded by a shallow moat. The result was war, an all-out battle for dominance on Monkey Island that captured the city's attention that summer. Of course, a real war was brewing at the time, and perhaps as a little comic relief amid that grim news out of Europe and Asia, the daily newspapers here covered the monkey war with great gusto and with tongues in cheeks. With that in mind, we present you a selection of excerpts, verbatim, from the Seattle Times and PI's coverage of the war on Monkey Island.
Dictator commands fighting zoo monkeys, and all's well. Woodland Park monkeys that were moved from their cages Tuesday to their new Monkey Island have had a civil war and set up a government headed by a Chinese monkey named Sing. The monkeys that had been living in separate cages for years at the zoo huddled together in their original cage groups when they were first put on the Monkey Island. Then they started fighting. If a monkey got licked badly, the other monkeys threw him in the moat. We had to put the down and outers in cages again.
Monkey apes dictators, or is it vice versa? Rebellion looms. Ruled by a stir-crazy Chinese monkey named Sing, the 16 inhabitants of Woodland Park Zoological Gardens, New Monkey Island, were plotting revolution yesterday, much to the amusement of spectators, but to the great concern of the zoo superintendent, solemn Dr. Gus Knutson. Singh, assigned to command of the island kingdom after two other simian dictators had failed dismally to unite warring factions, turned in a good first-day performance, knocked half a dozen malcontents into the moat, and cowed the others into reasonable submission. Is the boss crazy? He undid it all yesterday, however, by continually biting his own tail and then screaming with pain, an act which cast grave doubts upon his sanity.
Singh Dynasty on Monkey Island ends. Dictator gets dunking. The high-branded and tyrannical rule of Singh, the Chinese dictator who governed with absolute power on the Woodland Park Monkey Island for the past 2 days, came to an abrupt and ignominious end in the presence of hundreds of excited spectators. 17 Filipino monkeys who had been Singh's abject subjects since Friday rose in rebellion, dethroned him without ceremony, and drove Singh into the moat.
Zoo monkeys deposed flea-bitten dictator. The greatest sea battle of the War of Monkey Island was fought at sunset today, with the result that the mad monk of China, Tingling Singh, was badly defeated and exiled to that dismal St. Helena of Woodland Park, the Monkey House.
Truce declared in Monkey War. Outwardly, all was quiet on the Monkey Island battlefront here today, except for occasional fisticuffs between the monkey factions. But dissension was glaringly apparent as the different rivals for leadership in the simian community made faces at each other and held councils of war from time to time.
Queen is planning to make monkeys out of dictators. The slap-happy inhabitants of Woodland Park's new Monkey Island were pretty cocky today after having performed to a Sabbath crowd that Zoo Director Gus Knudsen estimates at 25,000 persons. But they'd better not get too chesty in their newfound notoriety, for a female is plotting against them. She's no ordinary Monkeyland Machiavelli, though. She's none other than Cheetah, the African Queen.
Monkey Isle under suspicion. There is so much revolution and strife on Woodland Park's Monkey Island that Dr. Gus Knudsen, the zoo director, says he may have to appeal the United States Immigration and Naturalization Service to investigate the monkeys and weed out the undesirable aliens. I don't know how most of these monkeys got into the country, said Dr. Knudsen. They may have come in illegally. All I know is that people bring them here and say, how about taking this monkey? And so I take the monkey and ask no questions. Adam, the stool pigeon, fell under Dr. Knudsen's suspicion as a fifth columnist. Adam is a small monkey who spends all his time shadowing other monkeys, gossiping about politics and generally stirring up trouble.
In Zoo Hospital, Singh reposed today in the quiet of the Zoo Hospital, where he's nursing quite a few cuts and scratches received in the big naval battle when he was almost drowned. Never again will Singh be placed on the island, according to Knudsen. Knudsen believes a permanent ruler will emerge on the island within a few days. Meanwhile, none of the monks seem to trust each other, and Knudsen is keeping a watchful eye on the proceedings to be sure there are no casualties.
The monkey drama held spectators in thrall for much of that August in 1940. Then, according to the website HistoryLink, interest began to flag, and people turned their attention back to another conflict. The escalating Second World War. This is Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and today our theme is pet projects. So this next story is about animals, but it's also about a very particular pet project. George DeVoki is a scientist based in Seattle, for most of the year, but don't expect to find him around here during the summertime. I can tell you where he'll be, though, on a small, flat little island in the Arctic Ocean off the Alaska coast called Cooper Island. Back in 1975, DeVoki was doing survey work there when he came across a colony of Arctic birds called manse black guillemots. They're little pigeon-sized birds with bright red legs, and they're one of the few seabird species that depend year-round on sea ice.
It was very interesting and very unique to find this colony. And I went back to the colony a number of times that summer. Never thought I would see it again. Never thought I would spend essentially the next 45 years of my life on that island.
Over the years, the importance of his research became clearer. These birds are perfect indicators of the warming climate. Since discovering the colony, Devoki has not missed a summer on that island, and for the majority of those summers, the only occupants have been Devoki and the birds.
I lived in a tent for 28 years. It was a four-person tent where I had a little stove and a place to sleep and a place to keep my notes and things like that. And one wakes up and has work to do as soon as you wake up, and certainly all the various maintenance things that you have to do to make sure you have enough water, because I used to melt pack ice for water, making sure that the stove works, making sure that the bears, if they're on the island, are not close to the tent. So as soon as you wake up, you have to deal with these things that you don't have any period where you can kind of lounge in bed for a while. And then the data gathering starts, and it can be an 8 to 12 hour day, depending on what's going on, just weighing chicks, catching adults, making observations. And it's a sort of lifestyle or the sort of daily routine that makes one realize that if you have too much time to think about things, your thoughts can go to various places that you may not want them to, in terms of getting depressed or things like that. But out there, you are so busy, you don't really have that indulgence of trying to think about what you're going to do next, because it's clear what you're going to do next. Because I've banded all the birds and know them as individuals, these became my social group. After I would get back to the cabin, and I maybe have an hour or so that I wanted to do something, I go, well, why don't you go out and see who White Red White is breeding with? Because she has two males who are interested in her nest site. So that was my social life as such. I mean, I would go out and I would see these birds, and I then had some place in the colony as such. I mean, because then I got to know them all as individuals, and it also makes me feel less lonely on the island.
If you wandered out in some evening just to say, oh, what's everybody up to? Paint me a little picture here, like so-and-so, so-and-so, what are they doing?
Well, we put three color bands on each bird so that I can identify them with binoculars. So that there's one bird who has a blue, an orange, and a blue band. And our shorthand for that is B-O-B, so his name, of course, is Bob. And those birds you can really relate to because you can say their names. We have one green, black, orange. Black, our code is a K for black, so it's Gecko, and he's Gordon Gecko. So guillemots have a 95% mate and site fidelity. It's very close to the human way in which the pairs operate. And anytime you see a bird that you know is mated with somebody else, like Bob, I've seen situations where White Red White, who was this one female who had a very active social life, had come over and was head bobbing and pairing with this bird because Bob's mate was offshore forming the eggs. And then what was really interesting is that as the colony grew, I banded a number of birds that were not breeding but were waiting for someone to die because all the nest sites were full. So those non-breeders, of course, had much more interesting social lives than the birds that were breeding trying to raise young. So those would be the birds I would go out and follow to see who they were paired up with, and they'd move around a lot and things like that. So it was, I mean, and as I say, it's the reason that Friends had a much longer time period on TV than Ozzie and Harriet, because like stable pairs trying to raise young, it's not as interesting as pairs thinking about breeding and wondering who they might breed with. Wow. So I knew more about them, or I knew as much as I did about their personal life as my friends' personal lives, who were also non-breeders at that point.
Yeah. Have you ever been close to quitting?
There is a time, almost every summer, and it's certainly happening now that things are not as good for the guillemots as they were in the 70s and the 80s and the early 90s, that I think, wait a minute, why am I doing this? I had one summer I came back and I thought, you know, I think this is the last summer. But then I realized if I was in Seattle on the 10th of June and was just having a good time, I would be thinking, who is White Red White breeding with this year? And it would bother me that I didn't know. It would bother me, and I think I have to go back and see this bird that I've tracked for the past two or three decades. Also, now, what happened after the study started finding these major climate change impacts and then got some national and international attention, I realized I have to keep doing it. What is going to happen next year, given the fact that this has happened over the past now 15 years in terms of the colony having trouble, birds not being able to raise young, numbers dropping, and things like that?
So, yeah, what is the overall kind of sweep of the
of the life of this colony now with the changing climate?
Well, the colony had 200 pairs in 1989 and 1990. It started dropping as the Arctic warmed down to last year, 100 pairs, and dropped to 85 breeding pairs this past summer in 2017.
So it's this population that has thrived since the Ice Age is now looking at a couple of pretty bleak fates, it seems like, extinction or potentially having to adapt into something that it hasn't been for millennia.
Right. And that is, it's the good news and the bad news. In terms of quitting, if I had just been doing a demographic study of the breeding productivity, the lifespan, and all those other things that people study in seabirds, I probably would have stopped it after 25 years. Now it is this natural experiment, but one that I wish wasn't happening. And I've been tempted when I've been interviewed and people say, glad to have you here. I am tempted to say, wish you'd never heard of me, because I could be just a very idiosyncratic person doing the 44-year study of a seabird on this island and not have it be tied in with something that indicates that fossil fuel emissions are warming the world.
So as you have watched the island change, this colony change and shrink and respond in all kinds of negative ways to the changing climate, I know you're a scientist and you're supposed to have some distance, but do you have an emotional response to that?
Oh, I mean, I have a very major emotional response. Once I started seeing more and more chicks dying, it was very depressing. And it was very depressing because the chicks hatch, they're okay for a certain period of time. If I know that the food is not common that year, if the fish they want to feed on are not common offshore, those chicks will be dying. So even when they hatch, I'm thinking, you likely won't make it. So I'm then weighing these very cute black guillemot chicks, knowing that they probably will be dead in a week or two. And that is exactly what happened. Like last summer, 2/3 of all the chicks that hatched died.
Wow, 2/3.
Yes.
Just for lack of food mostly?
Yes.
So how do you think about the value of this work that you have done? What difference does it make? And do you ever despair of it making as much of a difference as you'd like?
I was very taken with the fact that when climate change was just getting to be talked about in the late 90s, early 21st century, that people were interested in my study. When it seemed like there could be things that could be done. And now, of course, it is somewhat different because everybody is seeing climate change in lots of different places. So now I'm doing this because it still is frequently a way for people to relate to climate change, but it is really looking at how fast the canaries in the coal mine are going to be dying, as opposed to saying, oh, by the way, this is giving us a warning. Let's act on that warning.
Well, George Devoke is a biologist, and he's the founder and the director of Friends of Cooper Island. He lives in Seattle. Thank you so much for coming in.
Great. Thanks so much.
I'm Gabriel Spitzer. This is Sound Effect, and we've been talking today about pet projects. So all good things must end, including shows about pets. And the pets themselves. For many of us, losing a pet was our first exposure to death. And so to end our show, we have a story from Seattle journalist Tom Paulson about the end of a gray and white tomcat named Ollie.
He just attached himself to me early on and would come and sleep on my chest, or I'd find him there because I'd throw him off the bed, and then I'd wake up and find him. It's where he wanted to sleep. So we bonded early. And he just kind of was a male cat, swaggered around, thought he ran everything, and gray and white. And he just had this, Robert De Niro look to his face. You know, he just kind of looked at you like he's in charge, he's a tough guy, but not weird and scary like a lot of cats. I mean, had kind of a dog personality. So that's why we got along. I'm more of a dog person usually. They get old And I was working at the Seattle Post-Intelligencer at the time when it was a newspaper, and my wife called and said that Ollie had passed away and just died in his sleep, and I needed to come get him. And I'm like, what do I get him for? What? You know, he's dead. So I had to leave work early, which caused a little, I got a little bit of ribbing from my editor. I have to leave home to deal with a dead cat. So got home, and Ollie was in the bed, just curled up and getting stiff. So I told Deb that, you know, I'll just go and dispose of him. And she's like, what are you going to do? And I said, well, I don't know, put him in recycling or something. And anyway, that freaked her out. She was not in favor of that. And then I said, well, we can just bury him out in the backyard. She didn't like that idea because, you know, we might forget he's there. And when we're planting a rhododendron, find his bones. And I kept coming up with disposal solutions that she didn't like. And so I decided, well, I'll deal with it. And she took off. And downstairs I had a freezer where I put my fish and meat products. And I thought, well, wrap Ollie up in a bag and put him there. And I don't really know how to explain this, but I forgot about him. 2 weeks went by, and apparently she went down there looking for some fish for dinner, and she reaches into the freezer, pulls out the black plastic bag. It unrolled, and the cat rolled out and fell out onto the ground and was stiff and legs sticking up and, you know, not a good look. She screamed and was horrified, and then that became anger towards me that I would do something this seemingly uncaring. So I got a call again at work that I had to come get the cat again. She wasn't going to pick it up. I didn't tell my editor this time. I just pretended I was going to lunch. So I got there. He was still frozen. I wrapped him up and said that, you know, I will deal with it this weekend, I promise. And she didn't really want details. She just didn't want a dead cat in the freezer. So, well, the weekend, I was heading over to Idaho to open up our family cabin for the spring with my father and with my brother and a friend. And we always go up there, and it's still pretty cold. There's still snow on the ground when we open it up. It's just kind of something to do. And I thought, well, you know, we'll take Ollie with us to Idaho, and we can bury him up there. You know, natural environment, a lot of dead animals. He'll be fit right in. So we stuck him in a cooler and drove to northern Idaho where the cabin is. And my ethnic heritage is Norwegian, and so I thought, well, we should do some kind of Norwegian Viking burial. So I built a little Viking ship out of plywood and had a cat's head instead of a serpent's head and had a sail. So we wrapped Ollie up in a cloth, burial cloth, placed Ollie in the boat, put a little gas in there, you know, I suppose that's not really totally Viking, but, and then it was time to say goodbye. And it was kind of a gray, silver, one of those silvery gray days where the clouds are low and it was cold. We set fire to the boat and we pushed him out into the lake. Got like 3 feet out and the boat tipped over and the fire went out and Ollie came out of the boat and just floated like an ice cube. So I waded out in the water, got the boat, got the cat back, and well, what can we do? And so we just came back to the fire, built up a big pyre and put the boat and Ollie on that, and then set fire to that, and that's how we said goodbye. We don't value life if we don't really celebrate and understand and deal with death. And I think one thing pets do for you, other than give you, not cats, but dogs will give you unconditional love. Cats, it's very conditional. But other than that, because they don't last that long, if you grow up with pets, you grow up dealing with death over and over again. And you get, I think it gives you some strength. So I'm getting old enough where I think about how I'd like my death to be celebrated. And I would hope that if anybody cared at the point of my demise, that I'd get a very similar ceremony to what we gave Ollie, where it'd be a combination of the absurd and the tragic and mostly a good time.
Tom Paulson lives in Seattle. That's it for our show today. Sound Effect is produced by Kevin Kniestedt, the human of Stella, Jennifer Wing, the human of Coco, and Posey Gruner, human of Ellis. Our intern is Janae Janik, human of Icy, Smokey, and Fishy Jr. Erin Hennessy is our executive producer, and Jasmine and Petunia are her cats. We had help this week from Will James, Hachi, Tom Paulson, Ollie, RIP, and Martin Kamen, Julia. Special thanks to our Monkey War readers, David Dodman, Paige Hansen, Nick Morrison, Alisa Weinstein, Michael DeBonis, Alex Keefe, and Tracy Quasier. You can subscribe to our podcast and all the usual podcast places. And if you use iTunes, please take a second to rate and review us. Really, if you like what you hear, it's a great way to support Sound Effect and KNKX. You can also find us on NPR One or ask your smart speaker, play Sound Effect, the podcast. Got to be verbatim, play Sound Effect, the podcast. You can also find us on Facebook or send feedback to soundeffect@knkx.org. And come back next week when our theme is Biggest Fan. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, human of Zoe, and this is 88.5 KNKX.